This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you. In your town, your suburb.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt.
Is the typical Aussie backyard disappearing and backyard cricket along with it?
Someone get the bat. The family's here. It's the time of year. We're playing cricket out the back. When the rails arrive, they don't park down the side. 'Cause the cricket pitch is the middle bit between the garage and the drive.
So the Ashes start tomorrow. Christmas and family get-togethers are just around the corner. Will you be playing backyard cricket? Can you play cricket in your backyard? Do you have the space? Do you even have grass? And do we design and even build our backyards now so differently that the tradition of backyard cricket is dying out? And does it matter?
Get all the kids around. Hey, it's a great tradition, the Aussie backyard cricket ground.
And later this hour, we call it op shopping, but the younger generation call it thrifting. And as thrifting influencers and come thrift with me threads take over social media, some of its followers have millions and millions of people following them. Is thrifting as sustainable and as good for the environment as it seems? But backyard cricket's up next.
The garden counts as four, and over the fence next door is six and out, 'cause you went the cloud and you can't have any more.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Backyard cricket, is it still a thing? If you look outside your window now, is there the space? Is there any grass to play backyard cricket? And as we design our backyards so differently now, whether it be more about a plunge pool, less about lawn, will backyard cricket die out as well? And does it matter? Anthony Burke, Professor of Architecture, host of Grand Designs. Anthony, is it just a sort of thing we reminisce about now? Really simple, boxy backyards that were nothing but lawn. That's where we played cricket. And are those backyards just simply not being designed anymore?
Yeah, hi, Rochelle. Yeah, no, they're, unfortunately, I think this is where the cultural rubber meets the road of the housing crisis. You know, we're not building those backyards anymore. And for all sorts of reasons, but the main reason is that, you know, we're having much smaller building blocks and we're putting much bigger houses on those blocks. So the green space around the house is just sort of disappearing.
The idea of lawn, I remember watching the most recent, I kind of hate watch The Block for whatever reason, and they it's a sickness.
I need to see. Please don't.
I need to see someone about it. And they were revealing the backyards, and one particular couple had a lot of lawn. And this was in comparison to other yards that had everything from, I don't know, pickleball courts and saunas and spas and all sorts of things. And the judges were like, oh, look at this, grass. Space. How old-fashioned. Yes. And it was really sort of took them back. And they're like, oh, this is just like an old-school Aussie backyard. Do we need to look at keeping that type of tradition, or is it not even environmentally the right thing to do now?
Well, the thing about the backyard is it has some amazing benefits for us, you know, just from a health perspective, having that green around us, the planting, the nature, all that kind of stuff. There is so much research that says why that is a good thing to live with nature like that. Then on the other side of the equation, though, is having lawn, having grass, like we play cricket on, you know, that is the opposite of sustainable. You know, it's a monoculture. Mm. It takes a lot of chemicals. It takes a lot of work to maintain. And all of that kind of stuff is the opposite of a good life in the way that we're kind of determining that or defining that today. Now, I don't want to get rid of the backyard cricket. No one wants to get rid of backyard cricket. So the question that is for us, as I said, the cultural rubber meets the road, where do we find a new place for that, you know, spontaneous neighbourly game? I mean, I used to play cricket in the street.
Yeah.
I lived in the cul-de-sac, and so we would just, you know, put up a little box and go for it, you know. But that's the we can't do that anymore. So what's the alternative?
I know, and there's a real pushback against. I know there'll be councils that want people to remove basketball rings that are put up in cul-de-sacs and courts. You know, cricket in streets when we now have cars being diverted down side streets instead of main roads due to the sat navs that we have. The way in which we live our lives is just so different. This, I don't even have a backyard, says Jules in Strathmore. This has come through from Al, who's in Halls Gap. My mum showed the herd crew, as in the band, I'm presuming here, how to play backstage cricket at the Falls Festival in Tassie.
Brilliant.
And my Mohammed, who's in Altona, says there's a massive oval out the front of my house and I see a few local groups who get together and they play there some days. So if backyard cricket is moving out of our backyards because space is smaller or because lawn is not necessarily the right thing to do for the environment, do we have enough communal green spaces, Anthony Burke, to play cricket like, or is Mohammed quite lucky and one of the few?
I think the more green spaces we can have at a community level, the better. You know, more pocket parks, I think, bigger sort of verges for greenery, you know, on our footpaths, that kind of thing. These are the spaces where these informal relationships and meetings always happen. So we've got to find ways to promote that, I think. It's all about community. It's all about a neighbourliness, if you like. And we've just got to make those spaces happen. They won't happen in your private property, but they will happen if we give them a chance somewhere, you know, outside our front door. And why not start up a little cricket game? You know, I was talking to some homeowners yesterday. They were saying they met their neighbourhood 14 years ago at a Christmas laneway party, you know, in Alexandria here in Sydney. And, you know, and they are now living with those, with some of those people because they're renovating their home. So they've moved in with them for like 12 months because they met them in the street 14 years ago.
Oh, isn't that great?
That is amazing.
Before we have a chat to Sue, who's called through from the CBD, Anthony Burke is with you, Professor of Architecture, host of Grand Designs. We're just talking about how the backyard has changed so much that whether or not we can or can't play backyard cricket in there heading into summer. My family at the moment, Anthony, we're kind of house hopping whilst we're renovating and we're living in another house at the moment. And we went for a bit of an evening stroll and we all sort of went, wow, the vibe around here is really lovely. Something feels different. It feels like community. And all of a sudden it clicked as I realised there were a lot of, you mentioned the cul-de-sac, but there were lots of courts. So this particular estate, I think, that we're living in at the moment, there are heaps of courts, no through roads. The energy of that community is so different. It has, well, community is the key word. It bubbles to the surface. I have never seen so many basketball rings in my life. I reckon if we're still there at Christmas, let's hope we're not, but if we are, there will be a lot of outdoor cricket. I mean, do we even design with cul-de-sacs and courts anymore?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because we don't. We haven't been, I should say, because the car has dominated the way we think about our suburbs and the commuter suburbs and all of that kind of thing. And from a traffic point of view, you know, cul-de-sacs are a pain in the neck. You know, they're the opposite of an efficient sort of car network. But then you're trading that efficiency for all of the things you're just talking about there, that sense of community that you know it when you feel it. You know, it's you know it when it's not there, you know it when it's there. And it's hard to put a finger on exactly what the secret sauce is there. But look, there are loads of urban designers now who are well across this. And there is a huge push to try and bring back these kinds of, I'm going to call them intermediate sort of community spaces. They're not formal. They're not the community centre. They're not the library. They're the incidental spaces where we bump into each other. And again, the social research around that is showing that these are actually far more important than we ever really realised.
Yeah.
So look, in our backyards these days, we're stuffing them full of pizza ovens and jacuzzis and all the rest of it. And I kind of think, look, what? Why? Personally, I don't have a pizza oven. I don't want a pizza oven. I'm going to offend most of Australia saying this, but I think I'd rather go up the pizza shop, up on the one that's up the road.
And Anthony Burke, anti-pizza.
I know. Outrageous, right? So I kind of think, you know, like if that's a resource, if that's something that's just outside my door in the community sphere, why wouldn't I support that? you know, rather than having to have it in my backyard and take up all that space. I'd rather have a beautiful frangipani.
Sue's in the city. Hi, Sue.
Oh, hiya. Look, the both of you have answered your question about backyard cricket. It's about communal spaces.
Yeah.
And so I'm constantly surprised, having lived in Spain for a period of time, Spain doesn't have enough space. Doesn't have as much space as Australia does, but their housing developments on the fringes of the cities, whether it be Barcelona, Madrid or wherever, they're designed, they're actually even 3 to 4 three-level townhouses that are set around an enclosed space. So each of the townhouses has its own backyard, little front yard, but in the centre of that round of townhouses is an enclosed space, usually with a swimming pool, children's playground, plenty of grass.
And creating your own space within your community, Sue, there's a great text here from Ronnie, who's in Sandringham, and it says, our new neighbours purchased the house next door, bulldozed it, planted trees and grasses for the local kids so they had somewhere to play cricket after school.
Oh, there you go.
I wonder, wow, imagine being
like
in that position.
Park.
It's a privilege, but if you've got the privilege and the ability to be able to do it. Anthony Burke, thank you so much as always. And I have to agree, as much as the courts were really lovely to walk around, I took the wrong turn the other day. And let's just say it took me a long time to get back home because there's no through roads.
Great to talk to you, Rochelle.
Oh, good on you, mate. Anthony Burke, Professor of Architecture, host of Grand Designs. You can keep those calls coming through. Is your backyard still designed for backyard cricket? The Ashes starts tomorrow. Christmas holidays are just around the corner. Maybe you've got a tradition in your street, somewhere where you spend summer, where the entire street plays cricket. Is it still a thing? Do we still have the space to be able to do it?
Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Hey, Malcolm Ward, can we go thrift shopping?
What?
So my daughter asked me the other day if we could go thrifting. So on one hand, it was possibly my proudest parental moment. But at the same time, I was heartbroken. I said to her, it's not thrifting. It's op shopping. We call it op shopping. But the younger generation, they do call it thrifting. And social media feeds are full of thrifting influencers from all around the world. Come thrift with me. Some of them have got millions of followers. So it is touted as being sustainable, as being good for the environment. However, there is a little bubbling conversation that's happening that claims that the social media PR machine for thrifters means that it's actually just growing our appetite to buy and consume more. And that thrifting, so to speak, is not only ruining the op shopping experience, it's not necessarily that good for the environment. Lucianne Tonti, sustainable fashion editor and author. Lucianne, everyone knows that I am an op shopping addict, have been at it for decades and decades and decades. I have noticed, whether it be around the office, some of my younger colleagues, my daughter, don't call it op shopping, they call it thrifting, which kind of grates me. I don't know why it grates me, but there is a big social media trend and push all around the world to thrift, come thrift with me. Is this on the surface looks good for the environment, but when you dig down into it, is it necessarily a sustainable way to shop?
Well, it definitely is good for the environment when we are buying secondhand instead of buying something new. The issue comes in when we're still buying new clothes and then adding on, you know, with thrifting hauls. And so that's when we're kind of seeing it as increasing consumption and not actually having the intended effect, which is of the circular economy, which is to decrease the production of virgin products. So, and right now what's happening, thrifting is growing, and that's a great thing. You know, it's great to shop secondhand and extend the life of clothes. It definitely does reduce impact, like the data says, between 30 and 40% when you extend the life of a garment by 40 wears. And that's fabulous. But on the flip side, the fashion industry is still growing at an alarming rate because we are all on this hyper-consumption pattern. Yeah.
When I do happen to follow some thrifters, I don't know whether they've just come into my feed naturally I've set the algorithm off, you know, that they are there. I do witness quite a lot of overconsumption, so to speak. They are walking around with trolleys and literally chucking stuff into their trolleys, filling them up so that they are overflowing, talking about going multiple times a week and how they sort of, you know, miss thrifting when they're not there and how they have to get their thrifting hit, so to speak. But then it's resold a lot of the time. And the reselling economy, the side hustle there, you've got postage, you've got all of the packaging around it. So when it becomes a side hustle as a way, as opposed to just a way to shop and buy your clothes, does that come at it with a different lens?
Yeah, look, so the first thing to be very aware of is the dopamine hit that's happening when they're on that consumption wheel. And so it sounds like what you're describing is an addiction, and that's a problem when we're looking constantly to fill up something inside us with external purchases. So let's put that to one side. When we're talking about resale, look, I think generally speaking, resale is a good thing, because what happens with secondhand, the big issue is when we've got like junk clothing being sent offshore. And so if it's being resold in the local economy and we're keeping the value high and people who are buying it are seeing it as something valuable, like that's not a bad thing. Except for when we start pricing out people who op shop because they are op shopping out of need as opposed to the side hustle.
Does it fuel? I mean, we know that op shop prices are vastly different now. They're more expensive than ever before. And there's many reasons as to why that is the case. You know, the money is then used differently and passed on to individuals and families who need it. However, I think the beginnings of the resell side hustle, the idea that it's vintage, not just secondhand or from the op shop, has fueled this, well, someone's going to buy it and on sell it for profit, so we might as well stick a high price on it. This global movement of come thrift with me, is it just pushing op shop prices up?
It certainly is pushing op shop prices up, but the thing underneath that, which is really important for people to know, is that, you know, it's a very small percentage of clothing that gets donated in Australia actually stays on shore. So it's about 15%, 16%, according to kind of the latest reports. And that means there is, because of what's happening across the board with the quality of our clothing being in decline, new clothing being so cheap, there is this enormous glut of product that's going overseas. And so there's this kind of hierarchy shift that's almost happening, where now you have organizations like Thread Together, which actually will give people in need brand new clothing because the companies are overproducing by so much. So it's a very interesting space. There's lots of different dynamics.
There is, and I think the salon or the resale space is huge. If you look at something like Depop, it's got, I think to date, 49 million active listings. I've never been on it because I know once I'm on it, that's it. It could all be over for me.
It's pretty fun.
But the resale market, has that still got space to grow and to get bigger?
Yeah, and it will. It'll keep, I mean, right now it's growing 10% a year, and that is only going to increase because we are also just continually pumping out more and like a higher and higher volume of product. And that is what we would like to see in a perfect world is resale, you know, growing at like 50% and the fashion industry's production volumes being in decline. But I'm curious, you know, you said you've been op shopping for a long time. Like, what have you seen in those years? I was going to say decades, but I don't want to.
No, it's been 100% been decades.
I mean, what have you noticed? Because I've noticed in my lifetime a definite drop in the quality of clothing available.
Definitely. You know, there's a couple of key things. Price is one of them. I still know where the good cheap ones are, though. You just have to travel and, you know, be dedicated. Yeah. I've noticed the fabric, the quality of fabric, and just the amount of polyester and cheap clothes that are in. You can just know straight away by touch and by feel. The other thing I've noticed is the rise of the still with tags. There's even entire sections and signs that say brand new with tags. That's the bit I find the most disturbing, Lucianne, is how large that section of the op shop is.
Yeah, I'm with you. There's something very creepy about it too, because, you know, we wouldn't be able to be producing so many clothes if the products weren't so cheap. So, and polyester is the main driver of that, which you talked about when you're touching the fabrics. That's one. But the other thing is where the labor exploitation that fashion does not do a very good job of shining a light on. And so if you're making new clothes that you can still make a profit from when you're not even selling all of them, what's the markup? It's got to be pretty big.
It's fascinating. There's so many different texts on this. One, I've been reselling pre-loved clothes for many years. Recently, I've become really disillusioned with the thrifting, in inverted commas, movement, so much so that I'm stopping. I'm going to stop selling clothing. I only try and source sustainable fabrics, no polyester. Even still, as you say, it's just another way of overconsumption under the banner of sustainability. Op shops now have inflated prices to a ridiculous level. It's just getting out of hand. Yet another that says, my son left boarding school and became a resident of a big Melbourne college. He was sick of being a conformist, never developed his own fashion sense. Op shops have been amazing. He's definitely finding his own fashion sense. It's a very affordable method of experimenting. That's from Simon. And another, Lucianne, just finally, it says, yes, thrifting may be better for the environment, but it does not make you immune from overconsumption. The increase of op shopping, raising prices unnecessarily, it takes it out of the hands who truly need it. Only buy what you need, not what you can. And that's from Emily, who's in the Dandenongs.
Yeah, she's really nailed it there. That's the big one. If you're op shopping or thrifting to replace buying new, then that's when you're in the sweet spot. You've got to, you know, thrift with intention, maybe.
And let's just call it op shopping, you know?
Yeah.
I think as soon as it gives it a label, yeah, like thrifting, it's trying to make it cool. It's just like, nope, it's op shopping. Lucianne, as always, lovely to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Lucianne Tonti, sustainable fashion editor and author. Coming up in just a moment, do you think it's possible to be able to create a farm from scratch in 24 hours? Well, if Costa is somehow behind it, then the answer is possibly yes. But whether it be about farming and agriculture, maybe it's about op shopping and secondhand clothing.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Could you imagine trying to build a farm from scratch? So taking underutilised patch of land and in 24 hours turning it into a thriving farm, an edible, thriving, sustainable farm. How possible is that? Well, two men that are going to ensure, along with some help from the community, albeit James McLennan, who is one of the co-directors, one of the founders of Farm My School, and our very own Costa are going to be behind this big event. It's happening in Colac. James, let's talk a little bit before we have a chat to Costa. Farm My School are behind this event, this 24-hour Let's Create a Farm from Scratch in Colac. But this is not your first farm. So Farm My School, what is it?
Yeah, good morning, Rochelle. So Farm My School, we're a non-for-profit that partners with schools and local organisations to basically transform underutilised school land into commercial market gardens, basically to feed and we'll grow a heap of abundant food, and that goes directly into the community, not only into the school, to the school canteen, so the students are getting healthy lunches, to food tech, so they're learning about seasonal produce, but also to the broader community in the form of veggie boxes. So we employ a team of farmers to actually grow the food. They work with students to actually, you know, teach them about regenerative farming. It's part of the curriculum, and we can grow a lot of food in a very small space. So
when was the first one? It was down along the Bellarine.
Correct, yeah. So our first school we started 3 years ago, Bellarine Secondary College. We partnered with Bellarine Community Health on this project. We got an original seed funding through the Engage Grant, a Victorian Government grant, and then we basically built this farm back 3 years ago. Again, in 24 hours, we transformed what was a disused soccer pitch into the event was basically 2.2 linear kilometres of garden beds in 24 hours. So it's now 3.2 linear kilometres. It's 1.5 acres of market garden, and we're producing an average of 250 kilos of veg a week and upwards in summertime.
I'm trying to get my head around, like, visualising just how much... how big that is, how many vegetables that is.
That's a lot of vegetables.
That's a lot of veggies,
it is,
man.
Yeah, yeah. And in summer, it's upwards of 750 kilos a week. So it's a lot.
How have you seen the success of this farm transform that community, not just the school but the entire community? What has it done?
Look, I guess we have a lot of offerings as a part of Farm My School. It's not just the veggies. It is definitely the education program, yeah. So bringing in the students, but also students from... other schools as well. We also have our broader education program as part of workshops called our Nourish Series. So using the school facilities outside of school hours, we actually get, you know, celebrity chefs in or you know, authors to actually run cooking workshops for the community to come in and engage them with the food and gardening workshops from the farm too. We also have our corporate program, so corporate groups can come in and take part in what we do. So there's a number of ways we actually engage the community and see huge, you know, transformation in individuals and families and groups as well.
So you're taking that model and that concept, you're bringing it to Colac. Why Colac?
Look, in both schools that we've now working with, we wanted to choose areas that were actually food insecure, that struggled to actually put food on the table, or that weren't growing enough food locally to supply their local community. The North Bellarine is that, and that was why we chose that first of all. It was also a pocket of sort of low socioeconomic communities as well. So we want to be working with communities that we can have transformative change with. Colac popped up. It was the only school who reached out. We've had a number of schools. We've had, like, you know, well over 150 schools reach out interested in the program. But Colac, you know, ticked a lot of boxes for us, and they had the area, and they also had a really receptive community, not only the teachers and the staff at the school, but also the broader community too, who were interested in what we do.
I think that's the thing. The entire community does need to be on board with this, because they will all benefit from it, because then the health, preventative health, that flows on to everyone, especially at a time where we know cost of living is through the roof. We also know from diabetes to heart health, you name it. We did a story just yesterday on the rise in the misinformation of processed food, and what's being sold to us as easy and affordable is just not the truth. To be able to change generations of what is easy, what is accessible, what is possible, to be able to eat healthy and connect to your community at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that connection's a big part. The cultural connection that food plays, you know, for thousands of years we've been coming together around food. That's been lost, I think, in the last probably 20 to 30 years, increasingly in Australia. For us, I think we're seeing a big shift. As I mentioned, we're farming regeneratively, meaning, you know, spray-free and with nature. So when we actually improve the soil that we're growing in, we're seeing this increase in the nutrient density of the food, or how good the food is for us. And we've been doing studies to actually show that we can change the gut health biome of people within sort of 2 to 3 weeks of starting to consume this sort of produce. It's then impacting dramatically their mental health and well-being. And obviously, if it's students, their learning outcomes and their engagement with school too. So it's not just about, you know, eating a few carrots to be healthy.
Yeah.
It's such a profound shift we're seeing with a project like this.
So the project that's happening this weekend, where we're looking at trying to create a farm from scratch, can anyone come along and learn and benefit from this? I mean, do you have to show your driver's license that you live within a certain vicinity of that area?
No, not at all. It's anyone is welcome. We have a lot of people coming from the local Colac community and the school itself, but we've also got a lot of people coming in from all over Victoria, which is really exciting. The Build a Farm in a Day in Bellarine, we had over 600 paid guests, and we're thinking we're gonna hit the 1,000 mark for this one. To basically,
so what would need to be done on the day? Like, are you literally starting from scratch?
We have a an area in the school, and it's literally in the middle of the school, that was the Ag Hort area since 1972, I've been told. And we're going to be building 3.4 linear kilometres of garden beds by using organic inputs, so a range of ingredients with compost and straw, coffee grinds, and cardboard, and basically layering it all in lines to form our garden beds, essentially.
I'm trying to take myself back to school and the school environment, and ours was full of portables, you know, lots of asphalt. I wonder how different the school will just feel from having a living, breathing, edible garden / farm in the middle of it, and how the experience of just going to school will be different.
It sounds pretty airy-fairy, but it's a living, it's a beautiful thing.
It does sound airy-fairy, but it would be a beautiful thing. The middle of our school was dodgy old asphalt where, you know, the Year 7s had to fight the Year 9s in order to shoot hoops.
Or even worse, that the new AstroTurf that, you know, is actually hotter on a 30-degree day than concrete is. So if we're putting, a large expanse of green space into a school, it actually has a massive cooling effect, but it's increasing biodiversity. It's increasing, the oxygen levels as well. So students are having a lot of benefits other than just eating the produce.
So Costa's gone AWOL, but he will be there. He's probably getting himself ready. He's a very busy man. He says yes to a lot of things, but he has been an advocate and a part of the Farm My School project right from the beginning, hasn't he?
He has, and he goes AWOL often, but he has been consistently turning up to our events.
He'll be there.
Yeah, he will be there.
He's probably already there.
He probably is. He's one of our ambassadors, and he's been so supportive and just behind what we do. And yeah, he'll be there through the whole 24 hours as well. He'll be staying the night. It's
exciting. Well, speak of the devil. Costa, we love you for so many reasons, but one of them also being the fact that you are such a huge advocate for Farm My School. James is in the studio with us. You're going to be down there and a part of the working team to get this farm up and running in 24 hours. What makes you love this project so much, Costa?
Well, I think what I love about it, Rochelle, is that, you know, it's an example of how we can repurpose the thinking around a space. So for so many of us, you know, sport is this big thing. It's like all infrastructure is around sport. But then you go, hang on a second. Like, we don't play sport without good health, and good health comes from good food. So to see something like a sports field reinterpreted with the priority being on food, like, that just ticks all the boxes. And that's why I've been really excited about it, because it's an opportunity to shine the light on the role that food plays for children and students as not just their health but their career pathways.
I was wondering that, Costa, when you say their career pathways, how does a project at a farm like this, like Farm My School, do you reckon that actually does it changes people's pathways, their life pathways, their work pathways? Or, I mean, health is obvious, right, because you're teaching them about food. But are we creating the next generation of farmers, of chefs, of cooks, I don't know, food scientists?
Well, that's exactly it, because when we filmed the story down there probably about 18 months ago, 12 months ago it would have been, it was the right time to film, because the project had had some time to establish, and it was starting to reach its tentacles into the curriculum. So you had students coming out and sketching and drawing the plants. You had students taking the food and actually using it in their cooking classes. You had other students that were coming and doing work experience on the farm and getting to understand soil and soil life and the role of waste and composting and what that meant for the health of the plants. And then you've got the local land care group, which has been established for some decades. They're growing plants there, and they're planting the local plants to bring the pollinators to understand biodiversity and ecology and the ecosystem. So the students are tying their science in there, and you look at it as a holistic project. It touches every part of the school. It hooks into all curriculum and it just embeds into their life.
And it's funny, the link, we started today's program by talking about how different our backyards are to the backyards that we grew up in. Is backyard cricket dying out? Or is it just sort of changing venues? You know, like are we looking at communal spaces for backyard cricket?
Yeah.
And fundamentally what I think I love about backyard, I'm crap at cricket. Like I'm fresh air and you don't want me on your team. But what I love about backyard cricket is community. It brings the street together. It brings people together. And that's what fundamentally this project is about, Costa, as well. It's about the school community and the wider community, and we need that now more than ever.
Yeah, and from that community point, Rochelle, it's like food is the ultimate community bonder. And you can have someone look at some plants growing in a garden bed and they go, oh, we harvest the fruit. Whereas someone else says, no, but we use the leaves in stir fry.
Mm.
And then someone says, oh, we actually use just the shoots on that plant. And all the barriers are broken down when you sit down at the table, or in this case, when you actually sit down and start sharing the growing skills and then the harvest side of it. And yeah,
that's all about, yeah.
Cricket has been that big binder, but I reckon, you know, there's more people connecting around food, but we just don't. That just hasn't been in the spotlight, if you know what I mean.
There's like, nothing say, better than I left my sister-in-law's place the other week with a huge big bunch of parsley and I was so happy. I was putting it in salads and pastas and all sorts of things. There's just something so special about it. Costa, if you're involved, it will get done. You are such a hard worker. Enjoy the weekend and thank you for being a part of this, mate. Good to catch up with you as always.
Yeah, thanks heaps, Rochelle. It's going to be a great weekend.
See ya. James Bye. McLennan is with you as well from Farm My School. This is the second. A lot of thanks and love coming in for you, your team, and the community that you work behind. This says, go, James. Farm My School is the best. Super proud of the principal as well of the Bellarine Secondary College. And others saying, this is just marvellous. I so wish we had a garden to grow things in when I was at school. I've never seen a child that doesn't love playing in a garden, and there is so much to learn. I can only see the benefit in such an activity, and I'm so glad that schools are embracing this. Thank you for talking about it today. That's from Judith. Finally, James, you must be so proud not only of the idea, but the fact that it's, you need people to say yes, right? You can have the idea, but if people don't jump on board, it will never happen.
Yeah, definitely. And I think someone mentioned the principal at Bellarine. I think so. Wayne Johannesson's a principal at there, and he actually saw the vision very early on before this was all concept. So he was engaged. Now it's a bit different that people actually see it. They can touch it. They can feel it. They can experience it and go, wow, we want that. But I guess for us in growing, we do need funding. We do need support to actually start the farms. The whole model is that we actually, you know, are commercially viable by years sort of 3 to 5,
mm-hmm.
With all of our income streams, and then we can actually support ourselves, so we're not relying on ongoing funding. We're super lucky to have the support of Vic Health for this project. We were lucky enough to get some funding through the Local Food First program, and we've partnered with Colac Otway Shire and Colac Area Health, as well as Colac Secondary College, to make this a possibility over the next sort of, you know.
So if shires, if there's councils, if there's schools listening that think, I'd like a piece of this.
Yes.
Can they jump onto your website? Can they reach out? Is there a blueprint? Is there a way that other schools can put their hands up to be a part of it?
Yeah, look, effectively, we want to get this right. We don't want to just sort of jump to as many different schools and shires as possible yet. Yet being the operative word. We want to make sure we do it properly and well, and we absolutely want to create a blueprint of how this can happen, how we can sort of secure funding either through different grants or philanthropy. But absolutely, if there's avenues for different funding that we can actually work with more schools in the near future, brilliant. We're all ears. So
best of luck on the weekend. It's ambitious. Creating a farm in 24 hours. You've done it before. It'll happen again.
Thanks so much, Rochelle. It's going to be a great time.
People can jump on, have a look. It's called Farm My School. James McLennan is one of the founders of Farm My School.
On the
ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
We've been talking a lot about Australian music, rock and roll over the last couple of weeks, and happily so, whether that be music venues, whether that be free gigs. But last night it was the celebration, the night of all nights, so to speak, for Australian music. The Arias have wrapped up for another year. And of course, the band that we've been speaking about so much over the last week or two, Amyl and the Sniffers, they dominated the night. They picked up four awards, including Album of the Year, which is Cartoon of Darkness. Neil Griffiths is the editor of Rolling Stone magazine. Neil, you were there. You're the editor of Rolling Stone magazine Australia. So is the night just all hardcore rock and roll? Is it like the coolest place to be?
It does feel like that sometimes. The next morning you don't feel so rock and roll. You feel very tired and beside yourself. But no, last night it was pretty incredible. And as you said, the big winners were Amyl and the Sniffers. You know, they've been really tearing up the national and global scene for a while now, but last night was really kind of like their anointment of the biggest rock band in Australia for sure.
And they're just so great and humble. We spoke to the bass player's mum yesterday, but let's start off with the lead singer, Amy Taylor, her acceptance speech. This is a little bit of what she had to say.
I would like to say all immigrants welcome.
Every pub gets $1 million. I love the idea that every time we speak about Amyl and the Sniffers, it comes back to live music venues. But how was that acceptance speech for Album of the Year? What was the vibe in the room?
Look, obviously they won four awards on the night. I believe one of them wasn't even actually televised, but every time, obviously Amy is usually the first one to talk of the band and she always has something good to say. And that's kind of the charm of Amy as well. She's very softly spoken. She is a little bit awkward. She's not the most talkative person, but when you put a microphone in front of her, she's going to say something memorable.
Did she swear heaps?
She did swear a little bit. Yeah. She did, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. She swears like a pirate, which is what I love about her. Absolutely. Now, that wasn't just about Amyl and the Sniffers last night. There were a lot of other really exciting things happening. So there is an Indigenous rapper called Barker. Now, I understand that she got a standing ovation. Tell us the story behind that.
Yeah, that was a really special moment. The best hip-hop and rap release was probably midway, even a little after midway through the ceremony, but Barker was the first one to get a standing ovation. You know, fans of local hip-hop will know Barker very well, but this was her first ARIA Award and well-deserved, and, you know, she was very overwhelmed. You could tell she was not expecting this at all. She was in the category with, you know, the Kid Laroi and Hilltop Hoods, but look, well-deserved, and that standing ovation is something that's been coming for a couple of years, I'd say.
I don't know a lot about her, but I guess in the room too. And when there is a standing ovation, it's always really emotional. And the way older musicians, in particular rock and rollers, look out for each other and ensure that that next generation is coming through and being supported as well. Did you feel that in the room?
Yeah, I mean, like literally that standing ovation was completely organic. Kind of one person stood up and the rest, everyone kind of followed, because again, if you've been in the industry, Barker has been around for a few years, and she has been one of the favorites of the scene for quite some time, but never got that recognition. Again, this is the first ARIA Award, and I think everyone in the room was just in unison agree that she absolutely deserved this one.
So there's another artist that I don't know a lot about, but is making huge headlines overseas. So Dom Dolar is a music producer and DJ, originally from here, from Melbourne, has a huge following. He's been playing all around the world to sold out shows. What did he win?
So he's won the first ever Global Impact Award. This is a new one that essentially recognises Australian talents that are really killing the global stage, and Dom is absolutely doing that. In the last 12 months alone, he was on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine a few months ago, but overseas he has broken the record for one of the attendances at the stages at Lollapalooza in the US.
Oh, wow.
He headlined Ultra Festival in Miami. He played two sold-out shows at Madison Square Garden.
Far out.
Yeah, and even funnily enough, I caught up with him last night. He had flown into Sydney yesterday morning, and he flew back out to Las Vegas at 8 a.m. this morning. So the man is doing the hard yards on the global scene for sure.
I love it, and it's a Global Impact Award. This is a little bit of his acceptance speech.
Although it's the first year this award has existed, I feel like it should have been given out a long, long time ago to so many deserving artists. I can think of countless ones off the top of my head who deserve it. Right now as we speak, and I'm really looking forward to the coming years of the artists that are going to receive it in the years to come. I just wanted to say as well, if you're a young, aspiring artist at home right now, I've been doing this for 19 years, and I think my biggest tip would just be show up every single day and do it because you enjoy it and for no other reason. Yeah, don't worry about the destination. You've just got to really, really enjoy it, and you might be really, really surprised.
It's always interesting, Neil. Neil Griffith is with you, editor of Rolling Stone magazine, Australia and New Zealand. That was Dom Dolla, part of his acceptance speech for Global Impact Award. When someone kind of, you know, is an overnight success and yet they've been at it for decades.
Yeah, I mean, Dom, I remember a couple of years ago, he was playing at Splendor in the Grass, and all due respect to Dom, but he was just another DJ on the lineup. He was one of many. He played on the traditional dance stage, but he wasn't anywhere near as big as he is now. So he means it when he says it. He's been grinding for many, many years, and to see him doing what he's doing now is incredible. And next month he'll be back in Sydney playing his first ever stadium show. And we were actually in the Rolling Stone newsroom struggling to think, when was the last Australian band to play a stadium? Cold Chisel recently played CommBank Stadium in Sydney, but we can't think of like the last Australian artist to do a stadium show, and Dom is doing just that next month.
Wow. Gosh, I learned so much on this show. All of a sudden I'm going to sound cool to the younger crew. Neil, I was watching little bits of Tim Rogers' speech. So he was inducted, and you and I, into the Hall of Fame. And that's something really special but sort of sad at the same time has been happening over the last couple of weeks with the cancellation of the Amel and Sniffers gig. Mm. The spotlight came back to when they handed over their money for the night and put $5,000 on seven different bars, grassroots, grungy bars around Melbourne where music starts. Tim Rogers kept that conversation going last night. He was like, our music venues are dying out, They need your support. They're not charities that you've got to go to them. You've got to go and be a part of it. And the spotlight is firmly back on the health or lack thereof of our small live music venues at the moment. And a little part of me went, I can kind of sense a bubbling of another slam rally if we need it. Like, how do we keep the conversation going and the momentum going at the moment that live music is important? We celebrate it, we hang our hat on it, yet those who make it and produce it and support it are really not surviving at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly what Tim said, that if you buy your ticket and you go see a band or an artist that you might not even know, one, you're contributing to the industry, you're contributing to that artist, but you're also a part of a scene, and you might, as I think his literal quote was, you could be one of 12 people in that room, but you're a part of it. And that's so important. We just talked about Dom Dolla earlier. Mm. At one point he was playing bowling alleys to nobody. Mm. These live music venues are so important because it's where bands get their start. There's a famous story of Oasis's first gig back in Manchester was in front of the bartender. That was it. People need to show up and support these bands and artists because it is literally the livelihood of these artists. It's where they start.
Yeah.
And if we don't have these venues, where do you go? Where do they start?
I started to think when he was watching that, and of course, part of me felt so old that UMI are in, Hall of Fame inductees. I'm like, aren't they a new contemporary band?
Tim, as you would know, is very charismatic. His speech was really emotional too because he's quite the showman and he got choked up a couple of times.
Yeah, he wears his heart on his sleeve. Absolutely.
He does, yeah. And it was very obvious that this honour means a lot to him and the band.
And I do wonder where live music venues will be in 10 years. Like, we're worried about their health now.
Yeah.
Who are the next venue owners going to be? Where will that next generation come from? Because you can't just do it for the love, you know.
Yeah.
And I did start to think about the projection of what that will look like. Neil, thank you. It must have been a fun night. You're probably probably feeling it a little bit today, though, yeah?
Just a little bit, yeah, sure.
Part of the job, man. It's good to speak
always
with you.
Fun.
It is always fun. Imagine if that was your job. Neil Griffiths, who's the editor of Rolling Stone magazine, Australia and New Zealand, who was at the Arias last night. Lots of love coming in for Barker, who received an award on the night. Barker's life story is incredible. Extraordinary woman, a true queen. That's come through from Denise. And this, I can tell you, there are a lot of Australian music stars who do not pay their supporting bands well or on time either. So that's the other thing. How do you support Australian live music? It's a conversation that we've been having a lot this last couple of weeks, and it's a conversation we need to continue to have.
That's it for today. Thanks for listening. Take care, and we'll speak to you soon.